Good afternoon. So, last time we finished up introducing distributed systems. We mentioned how networks worked. We previously had talked about addresses. We talked about how routing allows us to actually have the network move things based on that address. So basically in the network, they have these tables saying, oh, if it the address is this range of numbers, move it to this connection, and that's how we can eventually get things to an arbitrary machine. And that's why we wanted to have these network addresses and not names, because that's going to allow us to use these compact tables. And then we moved on to more of what things look like from the applications, some things that are more high level. And we talked about two different abstractions for using a network and communicating between two applications on a network. And one of these was socket. So this is the interface that's implemented by POSIX, and it turns out by most other OSs, the most commonly used one, which essentially gives you a two-way pipe that works over the network. And this, we mentioned, was built on top of that mailbox model we learned earlier, but we get something that's a lot more convenient to use. And one detail we had to deal with in order to make this possible to implement is we needed to figure out, well, if I have multiple programs running on machine A and multiple programs running on machine B, how do I know when things are being sent between them, which program those things are going to? And our solution was this idea of port numbers that we'd assign sort of an additional address component that would tell us, once we got to the right machine, where is the program that I want to go to? And the OS would track that and use that information to decide when something came in on the network, what program should it wake up and let it finish reading? And also, of course, it would use this to, when a program wrote, to make sure it went to the right place when it was received on the remote machine. So after talking about sockets, which are kind of a very low-level way of providing access to network communication, we have this much higher-level approach called remote procedure calls, or RPC. And the idea of remote procedure calls is that we want to approximate the procedure call interface, that everything looks like a function call, but the function call actually calls a function not where you are, not a local function, but a remote function. And the way we do this is that we'd have some tool that would generate these stubs that would stand in for the other end of the call. So on the client side, the program making the procedure call, this stub would look like that function, but rather than actually doing what that function does, it would just package up its arguments into bytes, send them over the network, so they could be received by the machine where we really wanted to do that work. And on the server side, the side where the calls were being actually completed, we'd have a server stub which would do the opposite of that. It would take these bytes that the client stub produced, churn them back into arguments, and create a new function call, that should look the same as the one the client made. We saw, when I looked at some sort of actual examples of what an RPC system looks like, that, well, in practice, maybe the approximation of the, normal function calls isn't so much, even though we keep this high-level idea that it looks like a function call, it has an argument and a return value, but there's some extra stuff that goes on for a bunch of reasons. One of these is that practical RPC systems need to deal with handling machines with different architectures and want to go work between different languages. Another practical issue is that there are a bunch of errors that we're going to need to deal with that are just not possible in local procedure calls. And there's also some details as far as setup we need to do that don't come up in local procedure calls, like the client here somewhere it needs to specify where this server is over the network. And obviously, we don't actually have to do that in our code in a local procedure call. And we mentioned that, well, because we need to generate these stubs here. We need some sort of template for the tool to know what it needs to generate, what that should do. And our general solution to this was what we called an interface description language, sometimes abbreviated IDL, where we'd have information about what the arguments and return values were, what types of structs those would be, and what the procedure calls we wanted to support were, and this would be used to produce these stubs for our particular application and the set of function calls we wanted to allow. Then we talked about failure models, and that's where we're going to continue on today. So at first we mentioned that, well, you know, if we're thinking about using distributed systems to get better redundancy because we have multiple machines, maybe we can make it so we're going to have things fail less often. Well, in the sense that, well, maybe each machine might fail a lot, but hopefully the machines together, the system, won't fail. And to think about what failures we can handle, we need to think about, well, how can these individual machines fail? And once we know that, you know, how can we build a system that handles those failures? And there's two common models you'll see when people talk about distributed systems. So one is this idea of Byzantine fails, where when machines fail, the worst possible thing happens. So if you want to deal with any machine failing, effectively you have to completely not trust any one machine. You have to do something where you always check with multiple machines for absolutely everything. We're not going to go into the detail of how you'd handle this, but I mentioned this model to point out that we're going to talk about a much more restricted model that's maybe a lot less realistic, but is a lot more practical to handle and is pretty close to the kind of scenarios that we care about in the real world. And this is where failing machines stop, or maybe they don't stop, but we'll ignore them, so it's like they stopped. And our goal is going to talk about how can we handle failing machines temporarily stopping and then, you know, maybe coming back and make sure our system still works correctly despite that. So a question is, conceiving of an IDL as an API a good way to conceptualize what it is? So I would say the IDL is a way to describe an API. And that would be a good conception of what it is. It's the language for describing APIs. Other questions? Okay. I'm a little surprised I don't have RPC questions given I looked at what people answered on the quiz, but okay. Okay, so someone does want me to go over quiz question 3. So quiz question 3, the intended way that quiz question 3 would work is that this would be a remote procedure call. I maybe wasn't fully explicit here, but there's a client stub for a copy file RPC. So that means it must be a remote procedure call, that the copy file is something that runs on the server and the client stub is going to, you know, run that remotely. And given that, what the client stub is going to do is it's going to package up the arguments to the server. The server is going to make that actual function call on the server. And then we're going to package up the return value, this integer here, and send it back on the server, and the client's going to unpack that. And what this stub will do is, well, for packaging up the arguments, we do need to send them, but we don't want to send the pointers themselves because a pointer on my laptop isn't useful on my desktop because they're different memories. So that's why A isn't correct. And to deal with that, we'll need to send the strings instead. So we need to send the actual contents in the string. You know, we can't just send the pointers because the pointers aren't useful elsewhere. If we're doing a remote procedure call, then presumably that would mean the copy file operation must be happening on the server. So we shouldn't need to be sending back the contents of the file. All we're going to be sending back is this integer here telling us whether or not it worked. Okay. So then on question one, here, can I go with that? So on question one, we mentioned that the first four blocks are stored at located using these direct pointers, the next 512 using the indirect pointer. So that means blocks 512 plus 4 to 512 plus 4 plus 512 are going to be located using the first indirect pointer pointed to by the double indirect pointer. So the double indirect pointer points to a block of stuff. The first pointer there is used for 512 things. And the next block is the one we're talking about because we, you know, ran out of stuff in the what the first block pointer stored, that the double indirect pointer stored, and we're getting the next thing. And that's how we got 1028 here. So that's is a block 1028 of the file, numbering starting at 0, so it's the 1029th block. But we start at 0 as far as which byte number it is, because we said 2. And each block is 2048 bytes. That's why we're multiplying times 2048. So question for, some other questions I missed. So RPCs will use sockets to communicate. That is usually how RPCs are implemented, but if we have some other abstraction for sending things over the network, an RPC tool and library could be implemented using that. And then 4B, so asking, if multiple acknowledgements are sent, would the client exit whenever it receives the first one? So presumably the client would finish when it receives the first one, but it could receive more than one. Maybe I should have been more careful about saying that this includes possibly after it was done with that procedure. But you are correct that, the client will tell the application it's done, even though another acknowledgement is coming. In some scenarios. And then in question two, what question is, why do I write the commit to the log before doing anything? So we're doing redo logging. So we want to have the log have things we want to redo later. So it doesn't make sense to do them after they're already, to write them to the log after they're already done. We always write them before they're done to indicate that they need to be redone later, potentially. And then a question, is there a stub for each function call or a group of function calls or one server? So generally when we talk about a stub for a call, we mean that there's one for each call function call the client would try to make. When you're looking at, for example, gRPC, which we'll use in that last assignment, they sometimes call like the class that contains all the methods that you might call remotely a stub itself. You might see that sort of difference in terminology when we have a group of stubs, calling the collection a stub if you have like an object that represents them. Other questions? Okay. So, last time we've talked about dealing with failures, and we're going to talk about, and our last assignment's going to be about dealing with the simple fail-stop failure, so the machine just stops working, and dealing with it not by making the distributed system work all the time, but by recovering when whatever machine or machines failed comes back up. So that's what we're going to focus on. And we're going to focus on implementing this abstraction we'll call a distributed transaction. And this is going to be very related to what we saw with redo logging in file systems, and it's going to, in fact, share that the essentially the same implementation technique, but we're going to apply it to multiple machines. And the idea of a distributed transaction is going to be that two machines, or maybe more than two machines, are going to both agree to do or not do something. And we're going to make sure that this happens even if a machine fails, and we're going to make sure that, like we were asking for in the file system case when we did redo logging, that we end up with a consistent state. That's going to be our big goal here, is that we want a consistent state. We don't want it to be the case that, you know, after there's a failure and things come back up, that we're going to have some disagreement about whether the something happened or not. And you can see the relationship between redo logging, because basically we're trying to make sure that two things happen, you know, both at once or not at all. And that's what we were doing with redo logging in our file system, where we wanted, you know, both parts of, say, moving a file to happen all at once or not at all. Here we want both the thing that the first machine does for this operation and this thing that the second machine does for this operation to happen, or neither of them to happen. So our primary goal is going to be to have a consistent state, and our secondary goal is going to be to not have the silly solution to this problem and to actually, you know, do the operation most of the time. We're not going to let it be the case that we end up, you know, just making sure things are consistent by never changing anything. So to give an example of, like, a use case for this, let's say we have a database of courses, and we want to distribute it across machines. And the way we've chosen to do that is that we're going to use machines A and B for student records and machine C for course records. And we want to do an operation that involves touching both student and course records, like adding students to a course. And we want to make sure that even if one of the machines that holds the relevant records fails, that we don't have confusion after it comes back up about what students are in the course. We don't want it to be the case that, you know, your sys page shows that you register for a class and my instructor sys page shows that you're not registered. We want that to be consistent, even if the student records machine crashed or the course records machines crashed while you were trying to register for a class. And our solutions, so how we're going to use distributed transactions, we're going to make sure that the machines that are changing the student and course records agree to do it, and we're going to let them say no. If they say no, we're just going to try again later. But we're going to make sure that if they agree to do it, that it, you know, it's going to be consistent. And to show why this is kind of a difficult problem, let's look at sort of a naive way of doing it. So let's say, you know, I want to do this in the simple way. I have the same setup, and here's my proposed procedure. So I'm going to run the register you for a course code on machine A or machine B, depending where your student record is. So let's say you're on A. And what that's going to happen is machine A is going to tell machine C, hey, add this student to the course. They're going to wait for a response. Let's say the course is full, then they'll fail. But if the course is not full and they were added, then they're going to add the student to the course. So this is sort of our naive implementation, and this does not achieve good properties in the case of failure. So let's think about ways in which we have this inconsistency. And there's inconsistency, actually, even if we don't have failure. So we're going to start with that. So let's say I'm, like, querying from a third machine, but I'm looking at both the student and course records. And what could I possibly observe? Under this procedure, there's an inconsistency where I can look at what's happening, where I can like dump the course in the students, and I can see something that seems inconsistent momentarily. So questions, what does double checking mean? So I'm saying, let's say, read the student record again from the student record machine and read the course record again from the course record machine. Give another 15 seconds or so. Okay, so we think we have broad disagreement. So the way I would think about this is, let's think of when this third machine can be checking the student and course records. So one possibility is that we check here or we check here, either before this operation or after the whole operation. So in that case, the records are going to agree. There's no issue that's not any of these scenarios. So the problematic case seems to be when we're checking at least, one of the records in between, or we're doing some combination of checking them at different times. So let's think about the case where if we check both of the records here. So in that case, if I ask the student machine, is the student in the course? It's going to say no. No, not in course, but the course machine is going to say yes. And that corresponds to C here. And D. Now, the double checking is that, let's say after I do that, I ask again. Well, one possibility is I ask again here, in which case they will both agree and we won't have a problem. Another possibility is that I ask again, before the reply comes back to the course record, to the student record machine. I could just ask again right afterwards. I double checked, but doesn't change anything because, I just checked too quickly. It was taking a while for some reason, just randomly, for that reply to come back to the student machine. Or maybe it just took a while for the student machine to process the reply. So both C and D are definitely possible. So for A, if you check the student record, then the course record, I don't think you can have this scenario. And the reason why is that, let's think we have to check the student record either either here, either before it's added to the course machine or after, but we can't check it after it's actually added to the student machine. And we have to check the course record either here, either before it's added to the course machine, or So, student record, for the student to be in the course, that means we have to check it after it's added, after the student's added. But if we check the course record that after that, well, you know, if it's added to this on the student machine, it's added to the course machine. Because this procedure kind of guarantees that. We have this dependency that if it's the course record's updated, you know, then the student record might be updated. If the course record's not updated, the student record can't be updated because of this procedure. Question, isn't there a delay between Telma remote and when remote actually does it? Yes. So, well, yes. This is why I abbreviated the procedure, but I was intending that this question was about what I showed on the previous slide, where, you know, we wait for a response here. So then this is assuming after waiting for a response. I'm sorry for, I wanted to make this slide, this fit on one slide comfortably. And I just didn't put that there. So the correct answers are C and D are the correct answers. Those are both possible. D is possible because we can double check too quickly, you know, so nothing may have changed. You know, for the double checking strategy to fix this problem, we need to make sure we wait long enough, and it's hard to figure out how you know how long to wait. Now let's think about this case with failure. So here, I'm saying, what if there's a machine loses power in the middle of this? Question, I'm asking if the machine fails, or I'm asking either fails. So question is, in this machine, does the local machine only add the student to the course if it knows the remote was successful? Yes. We'll assume the same thing that, you know, after getting a reply. Because we have this scenario where we want to, like, make sure we don't add the student if the course is full. Okay, so we have broad agreement that D is possible, and if we're checking after the power loss, you know, we would never get this scenario where the result would change, and this is a considerably worse inconsistency than the previous example because, you know, let's say, you know, what the crash is, that we have a crash of the student record machine here. In that case, the student's added to the course, and there's nothing that's going to make us actually add the student to the course on the student record machine. And actually the same is true if, for example, the remote machine crashes after it adds the student to the course, but before it can send a reply to the student record machine. And so there's these two ways where we can end up with the, you know, course saying the student's in it, the student saying it's not in it, and unlike our first scenario, no matter how long we wait, the scenario is going to persist. You know, it's not going to change if we keep waiting. And that's the big thing we want to really avoid. You know, maybe we can tolerate these sort of little inconsistencies, but we really don't want these sort of crashes making those little inconsistencies stay around forever. So we're going to talk about a solution that's going to deal with both of these inconsistencies. We're both going to solve this problem of, you know, having this inconsistent view of what students are in what courses, and we're going to solve this problem, the probably more important one, that if a failure happens, we want to make sure that that the result in the long term is that we get, you know, the student, we have consistency here. That either we don't add the student at all, or we add the student to both places. So question is, D is the only answer, assuming we're talking about querying after the power loss and restart that causes a problem. And C is also possible if we assume the power loss or restart happens at some other point in time that doesn't affect the long-term result, like if it happened like here, for example, or here, then C is also possible. So we're going to go over the solution we're going to go through today, which is our subject of our last assignment, which is going to have this property, these properties. So we're going to have a solution where, like the scenarios I've been going over, each machine is only going to handle its own data. So we're going to avoid an actually simple solution, which is just sending everything through one machine. That if we just have one machine responsible for all the student and course records, you know, even if it's delegating some work, you know, if it has that, you know, that final answer, then that would solve the problem. But we're not going to like that. That kind of gets rid of the point of having a distributed system. And we're going to avoid involving machines in this distributed transaction operation if they don't have relevant data. So, for example, we want it to be the case that if we separated our student and course records, that if I'm making changes to courses that aren't changing students too, that the student machines don't need to know about. And if I'm making changes to students that are only on machine A, student machine B doesn't need to know about it, even though they have share some courses in common. And we want to make sure that we make some progress as long as machines don't fail. And, you know, when you think of distributed systems, you might think of, oh, thousands of machines. That is a goal. We'd like to handle that, but we're going to be talking mostly about, you know, a small number of machines coordinating, typically 1 to 3. So the solution that we're going to use that deals with this property is going to be known as two-phase commit. As you might guess, there are two phases. And the first phase, we'll have a more formal name for it later, is where we're going to figure out what to do. So we're going to figure out, you know, think of like, are we adding the student to the course? You know, I guess we're not, are we, but, you know, we're figure out that, yes, we plan to add student to course, and then we're going to actually add student to course. And this should remind you of redo logging, where in redo logging, we, you know, wrote down our plans in the log, and this is something we're going to end up doing here, and then we actually did them. And we're going to do the same thing, but we have multiple machines, which is going to make it a little more complicated. And part of this is going to be a log, but we can't just have a log on, you know, one place because we have these separate machines. But each machine is going to have a persistent log that it's going to use to remember what it was doing on failure. So Each machine is going to, for all its operations, follow the redo logging idea of writing down, I am doing this, and then doing it. Where the idea is that, you know, after failure, redo what was in progress. Question, is this identical to redo logging? So the main mechanism we're using is redo logging.
Yes.
We're going to apply that to make this work, to coordinate between multiple machines. Now, when we're doing redo logging, we're only going to be logging things that are about our current machine. So we're not going to like store everyone's data everywhere. We're just going to store the stuff we care about and also information about the other machines we were talking to, but not the data they're storing. Like if I'm updating, you know, doing that as student to course, I'm not going to like have a copy of all the course information. I'm just going to have enough information to know where the course is and what machine I was talking to. So this is the local part. So as far as the remote part, we're going to divide the machines that are participating in a transaction into two roles. We're going to have one machine we're going to call the coordinator, and the other machines we're going to call workers. I'm going to speak of these as if these are separate machines, but in a typical implementation, we're actually going to have one physical machine be both a worker and a coordinator, but it's going to be simpler to explain things if we think of the coordinator as something separate, even though it's going to be convenient to run it on the same machine as one of the workers. And this is a role that's not system-wide, but for a particular transaction, there's going to be someone coordinating that transaction. So someone's assigned to, you know, coordinate the operation of adding a student to the course, and the workers are the machines that actually have the data being updated by that. So in the machines with the student and course records. And our typical implementation is that we probably choose either the student record machine or the course record machine to be both a worker and a coordinator to make sure that happens. And the way we're going to ensure consistency is that we're going to allow the operation to fail. Is that we're going to figure out whether we can do the operation, and if anyone involved in the transaction, if the coordinator or any of the workers give some indication that they can't do the operation, we're going to not do it. We're going to make sure it doesn't happen. Only if we get verification from all the involved machines that they're okay with this, that are we going to allow this to happen. And this is how we're going to ensure consistency, because if the machines say it's okay to happen, they're going to be set up with their logs to make sure it does actually happen. So the way we figure out whether everyone is going to actually do the operation is that we're going to have the coordinator collect what we'll call votes from the workers. And the votes are just saying, can you do this or not? And the coordinator will, after collecting those votes, will make a final decision. So if all the workers say, yes, I'm going to do this, I vote to what we'll call commit this transaction to actually do it later on, then the coordinator is going to choose to commit that operation. And if one of the machines says, no, I can't do it, so why would they say no? So one example would be if something failed. Another example would be if, like, you know, the course was full, then the coordinator is going to choose to abort the operation. And we're going to have this one coordinator for the entire operation, and the coordinator's choice is going to determine what we end up doing overall. The coordinator is going to make the final decision. So this here is the final decision, whatever the coordinator chooses here. And importantly, we have to deal with machines failing. And the big tricky thing about dealing with machines that failed is, well, if we don't get an answer from the machine, we don't actually know what happened before it crashed? Did it say I wanted to, did it agree to do the operation? Did it not get the message at all? So in the case where we collect our votes from the workers and two of the workers say, I want to do this, you know, I can do this operation, and one says it can't, the coordinator has two options. So one option is it can wait for the machine to come back up and get an answer. Another option is it can say unilaterally that we're not doing this operation because something happened. So some questions. Is this saying that each machine runs one coordinator plus worker? So hopefully, as this makes clear, we're going to have one coordinator for multiple workers. It might be the case that some of these are located on the same physical machine, but they're conceptually separate. And the question is commit here, the second commit. So these commits are, this is what, these are the votes about what to do, and this is the sort of outcome on the right side. So commit or abort is going to be the outcome of our transaction. Commit means we're actually going to do it, and we're going to do the whole thing no matter what happens. Abort means we're not going to do it, even though the machines might be ready to. Questions about this idea of voting and having the coordinator make the final decision about whether we make the transaction happen, that is commit, or abort it, make it not happen. So question, is it possible that only some workers are needed for an operation? So in two-phase commit, we're not going to involve them at all in the transaction if we don't need them. So if, for example, in a case of our two student record machines and our course record machine, a transaction that modifies student records on machine A and course records on machine C would only involve machines A and C as workers. So question is, each row in the transaction is an image. Each row is a transaction of the image. Each row is, a possible outcome for a transaction. Other questions? So each row is a sort of a possible scenario that could happen for one transaction. So what we're doing here is that, this way is that if nothing's wrong, we actually do the operation. If any worker has some problem doing the operation, we make sure it doesn't happen. And if we don't know what's going on, the coordinator can make the decision to make it not happen. That's going to be safe because we still have time to make sure. So question, is the vote saying the machine has finished the operation? No. So these are these are basically what the machine would like to do. But doesn't mean the worker... mean workers have done operation yet. In fact, they better not have until they hear from the coordinator. Have they logged the operation? Yes, as we'll see later. Okay, so we talked about this idea of aborting, and sort of one thing that's going to come up with this, with why we have this abort option, is that we want to deal with conflicts between transactions. So let's say there's two operations that we're adding a student to one course and a student to another course, and the course record machine that holds course A needs to reconcile these two transactions. And let's say this machine is waiting to figure out whether this operation will happen. So this first transaction here is pending. And the question is, what does the Corsair machine say? Say about transaction two. Does it say that that's allowed or not? And Abort gives the worker a good option to deal with this question. That it can say, well, it looks like that I can't do this. That might not be true, but it looks like I can't do this. I'm just going to say, no, sorry, there's a problem. Try again later. And that's effectively what aborting means. Try again later. This doesn't work right now. Or alternately, another solution would be that the worker can say, well, not going to respond yet. I'm going to wait till I figure out what happens with transaction one before I reply about whether I'm going to want to, be a commit or abort voter on transaction two. Questions about this idea? Okay. So part of... the question is course full locally. So in this scenario, the course is not yet full locally, but the worker has with course A, has promised to do something, that they're willing to do something that might make the course full. So it's in this uncertain state. And if we want these to have a consistent view of things, if we want to avoid the scenario we saw earlier of that we could observe these inconsistent views of the courses and students, we want to prevent observation when we're in this maybe it's going to be full, maybe it's not state. So we're kind of in between deciding whether or not that happens. So the solution for this is that we're not going to allow values that are in flux, that are potentially being changed by an active transaction, to be read. And the reason why is because we don't know what that value is right now. We don't know whether the course is full or not. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. So in practice, the typical solution for this is that the reads are going to use the same kind of transaction process as writing. That reading what courses are full, we're going to do the same, do we agree to do this or not, commit, abort idea. In the assignment, we have a simpler version of this where we're going to have you track whether values are currently in flux, whether they're being changed, and the workers are going to have this unavailable flag when we do. So you're going to say, oh, no, don't have a value for you, sorry, because it's being changed. So questions about this idea about read consistency? Okay. So we saw this voting idea earlier, and a key thing to make this work is that it needs to be the case that when the coordinator sees that all the workers have voted to commit, that they can never change their mind. Because if so, if let's say one of the worker crashes, we need to make sure that that's still the case. So we want to have this property that when the worker agrees not to abort, votes not to abort, votes to commit, and voting to commit is agreeing not to abort, it can't change its mind. That it has to make sure that happens even if the worker crashes. And more importantly, when the coordinator makes a decision to either commit or abort, we need to make sure that that is not forgotten and it doesn't change its mind. That we can't have the coordinator at one point decide to abort and later on decide to commit. It has to, once it decides to abort because it didn't get an answer from a worker, it can't then change its mind when it gets that answer. It needs to say, sorry, I'm still aborting. Because if it doesn't do that, then we might have an inconsistent state. So our solution to this is that the coordinator and the workers are going to write down their decision in the log before acting on it. Where acting on it includes sending it to anyone. So before the worker tells the coordinator, I'm going to vote to commit this or I'm going to vote to abort this, it's going to write down in its log that it did that. So if it crashes, if it has a power loss, it will do that again. And before the coordinator tells the workers, hey, the outcome I've selected for all of us is that we're doing this transaction, it's going to write that down so later on it doesn't change its mind. Okay. So now that we sort of know the high-level structure, let's go into sort of details a little more formally. We're going to talk about our two phases with names this time. So we're going to have our first case we'll call preparing. And this is where the workers are going to tell the coordinator that they agree to commit or agree to abort. Then the coordinator is going to collect those votes in the second phase, which we'll call finishing, make its decision, and tell everyone that decision. So in the preparing phase, the coordinator is going to ask all the workers, hey, this is the operation we'd like to do. Can you do that? And the workers are going to reply that they agree to commit or agree to abort. If they agree to commit, they're making a promise that, yes, they're going to accept this operation. So if they agree to add a student to a course, they're not going to come back later and say, sorry, the course is full. They're going to add the student to the course because that's what they agreed to do. They can't undo it. If they want to, like, remove the student from the course, they, like, need to start another transaction or something. Or they're going to agree to abort, in which case they're promising that I'm not going to do this operation, forget about it, please don't do it, and they're going to record that so later on they don't make a conflicting decision, because we can never take back this agreement. And this promise to accept the operation means in something like adding a student to the class, we need to like temporarily reserve a seat to make sure that that promise holds true. Okay. So the coordinator is going to collect this information and it's going to make that global decision that's going to write in its persistent log, and you know, that's going to mean that even if there's a failure of the coordinator, we're not going to have a problem. So there's two cases we could imagine the coordinator failure happening. So one is the coordinator could fail before it writes down its decision. In that case, it's going to collect the votes again. If it writes down the decision, it's going to send that decision out potentially again. So the coordinator is going to send that decision to all the workers. So if the coordinator tells the workers to commit, the workers are actually going to apply the transaction. They're actually going to add the student to the class. They're going to stop saying that it's in flux. I don't know how big the course is right now. And if the coordinator says abort, they're going to undo the operation. Let's say you want to do it again later. You'll make a new transaction to do it. And we might say, well, what happens if the coordinator tells the workers and the worker like crashes before it applies the transaction? Well, the worker can ask the coordinator again, you know, or the coordinator can make sure it gets a confirmation from the worker that, yes, it actually applied the transaction. And this is what we'll be doing in our assignment, so that the coordinator can make sure that the worker said, yes, I committed this, I'm set. And if that doesn't happen, the coordinator can make sure that it retries until that happens. The question is, how is the coordinator chosen? That is a choice that, you know, is arbitrary. We just need to choose one. It's just some machine needs a little extra responsibility in this design. The question is, commit transaction mean log or just do it? So, sorry, probably I should write like, at, you know, do transaction here, because that's really what we mean here, is that we actually need to make the transaction happen. So question is, what happens if these messages are lost from the coordinator or lost during transmission? So with this option two, the coordinator is not going to get a reply from the worker saying, yes, I did it, and it's going to resend them. Question, does do transaction involve the log? It may. Yes, the workers may want to record what they're planning, that they're actually doing it to the log before doing it, just as before. Other questions? Okay, so one way we can visualize this is that our typical operation here is that during normal operation, the coordinator is going to tell the workers to what we'll call prepare, which is asking them, will you do this? And the workers are going to reply that they agree to commit or agree to abort, and the coordinator is going to commit or abort. And before we send all these messages, we're going to write down what state we're in to remember what we need to do next. So in this case, we'll see why I chose this name later, but we're going to say the coordinator is waiting, you know, is in the state where it's waiting for replies from the workers, and the worker is going to receive this prepare message, and before it tells the coordinator, I agree to commit this, it's going to log that it's in the agreed to commit state for this transaction. And then the coordinator is going to make its decision. But before it sends it out, it's going to log that it made it what its decision is. So it, if it crashes here, there won't be a problem. Questions about this normal timeline? And if there's an abort, the coordinator will do similarly, you know, ask a worker to do this operation. The worker will say it wants to abort. And no matter what the other worker says, the coordinator's decision has to be abort. And it will send that to reply to the worker. Question is, what was the worker's state before? Presumably, it was some sort of waiting, init state or waiting. We'll give a go through this a little more formally in a bit. So let's, now that we know sort of the properties, yes, when can a worker send a vote to abort? So we have pretty good consensus with these people who answered quickly. So D, B is definitely yes. That if it previously voted to abort, it can keep saying it voted to abort. So A is not allowed, and this is because we cannot change our mind. And what we're changing our mind in this case. Presumably the reason we're getting a duplicate prepare message is that, you know, our first reply may have been lost. Lost, but we don't know that for sure. Maybe the first reply is still going to come back later. We assure that there's no problems by never changing our mind once we send it. We don't make assumptions that it didn't get there. And for the same cannot change our mind reason, we can't do it on C. We might want to do that, but sorry. You know, we can't change our mind because we don't know that the coordinator didn't make a decision already. And you know, the coordinator doesn't know that. We didn't, have a reliable way of knowing we changed our mind. And the same is true in D. We can't change our mind, even though it would be nice to, you know, resolve the operation. Let's ask a similar question for... So we're asking when a coordinator can send the final decision, so to abort. Okay, so majority have correct answers. So C, we can do, because the coordinator can just unilaterally decide to not do the transaction and we try again later. Like, that's not great for progress, but that's always an option. And A is also okay. We can decide that, well, I don't want to deal with this. I'm just going to stop it. And that's okay because we haven't made a decision yet. So we can make our decision that we're deciding that the transaction's not happening. The question, isn't A not including a worker in the transaction? So the worker's not included yet, but we can just tell the worker, hey, here's their transaction, and by the way, it's getting aborted. And that's fine, even if that worker wants to commit the transaction, we can still have it aborted instead. So B is not allowed because this is changing our mind. Our log doesn't indicate any workers are contacted, but our log indicates the next thing we were going to do, next we were going to contact, we were going to contact workers. So it doesn't seem safe. So some word of this decision may have leaked out to the workers. We can't change our mind. Questions about these answers? Okay. So one property you may have noticed from this example here is that two-phase commit is what we call blocking. That, you know, while a transaction is pending, we can't, you know, we can't just give up on that transaction, even if it's taking forever. You know, we just have to say, maybe this is going to happen. And you might say, well, what happens when a machine, like, actually fails forever? And, you know, can we just not do anything? And in practice, the solution to this kind of scenario is manual intervention. That if, you know, if you really can't actually, you know, recover the state of that transaction, you'll manually fix the problem. And why this might happen is, let's say, you know, rather than our coordinating crashing and getting rebooted, our coordinator, like, fail the disk with a log on it, you know, gets shredded. Well, in that case, we're going to need manual intervention to fix the problem. So, to think about these protocols more formally, we're going to specify them with state machines. So I kind of alluded to states earlier as this is kind of what we'll usually store in our log. We'll say every machine is in some state. It knows what state it's in, you know, typically stored, you know, based on the log, we'll say when we go into a state, we write down that state in the log, and every machine knows what every message does in this state. And this is a common way to formalize distributed protocols like this, because this avoids a very common issue of not knowing what a message should do or not accounting for what if this message is received later, what do we do? So sort of as an example of sort of a high-level view, here's our coordinator state machine. So we can say the coordinator starts in the state I called init initialization, and it transitions to this waiting state by sending this prepare message to all, and then it goes into either an aborted or committed state when it either receives agree to commit messages from everyone, this has to get keep a counter, or it receives an agree to abort, or it gives up on getting a reply from a worker. And when that happens, when it transitions from waiting to aborted, it's going to tell all the workers to abort. And when it transitions from waiting to committed, it's going to tell all the workers to commit. So this waiting state, we accumulate votes. There's some extra work that, you know, if we aren't getting a reply from a worker, probably we need to, like, send it again after, you know, ask it again. And in this aborted state, well, we need to handle the detail of what if, you know, a worker, you know, doesn't get the aborted message, we need to resend it, and the same for our committed message. Now, something that might happen when we have failures of the coordinator is, let's say we fail in this waiting state. Well, in that case, when we reboot, we're going to do what we did to get back into the state again. So we're going to redo sending the prepare message to everyone. And you might say, well, that's going to mean that we're going to have duplicate messages. That's going to be okay. We're going to make sure we don't get confused by marking each message with which transaction it's for. So when a worker receives two prepare messages, it can say, oh yeah, I already logged this one, here you go. You know, I already made the decision, I got it for my log, here it is. So when the coordinator crashes, it's going to read its log, resend the last message, which may or may not actually have been sent, but probably resend it. And that's how we're going to recover. So maybe a less simplified version of this would be that we have this extra information about what actually happens in the state. And this is why people like these state machines for reasoning about these distributed protocols, that we can kind of look at this and say, what happens if I get a prepare here? Sorry, what happens if I get a vote here? I accumulate it. What happens if I get a timeout here? I resend abort. What happens if I get a timeout here? Sorry, resend prepare. What happens if I get a timeout here? Well, I resend the abort, same thing here. And we can kind of make sure that, you know, we know what to do. Let's say if we get, you know, agree to commit in any of these places, we can make sure that we know what's going to happen. Okay. And we can do the same kind of diagram for the worker. The worker starts in this init state. It waits till it gets a prepare message. And it sends either agree to commit or abort. And when it receives prepare messages in these other states, it knows what to do. We know, oh, if we receive a prepare message and agree to commit, we just say agree to commit again. Receive a prepare message and agree to abort, we say abort again. And I've kind of shown these state machines a little bit informally. But sort of the idea here is that, you know, especially when we're doing this for a much more complicated protocol, you know, we really want to specify sort of the result and action of every message. So the worker receives abort and aborted. What do we do? It receives abort and init. And if we make sure we've handled all the possibilities, we can, you know, make sure we haven't missed something. And that's a very common problem in these distributed protocols, is that you'll miss, you know, cases. Like, it's easy to miss, oh, I could get a prepare message again when I've already think I'm aborted. Or I could get a prepare message again when I commit. This makes sure we don't miss those cases. So questions about the state machine view of what workers and coordinators should do. So as I mentioned, we're going to have a two-phase commit assignment, and this is a very simple example of two-phase commit. We're going to have multiple workers that are going to store a single value, and the goal is that all the workers, so which I call replicas here, have the same value or unavailable. That if I query multiple workers, you know, and the value is currently A, all of them say A. If the value is changing from A to B, they either tell me A, they all tell me B, or they tell me like some A and or unavailable. So there's going to be this unavailable state, but the idea is that if I, you know, ask a worker what's the value, it's going to say A, then B, B, B. And if I ask two workers what the value is, they're both going to be saying A or both going to be saying B. We're not going to ever be able to ask one worker and find out the value is A, and then or ask worker two what the value is that says B, ask worker one, worker one still says it's A. We're not going to have that kind of disagreement where, you know, so where worker one says A, and worker two says A, B, B, you know. We aren't going to allow this sort of temporary disagreement where we have some period of time where we can notice that the two workers have different values. So what should happen instead is that the workers say the value is unavailable if they don't know what it is right now. And we want this to happen even if there are failures. And in the assignment, we're going to have the coordinator talk to the worker with RPC calls. This is both easier to write than socket stuff and also lets us have testing code that checks for network failures for you. And the coordinator is going to be the talk to the workers, and the workers are not going to contact the coordinator. So the only way the workers can contact the coordinator is by replying to RPC. So for example, the coordinator is going to ask the workers to prepare by making a prepare call. The workers are going to send their agree to whatever by returning from that remote procedure call. And the RPC system will detect sort of network failures. And this assignment's going to be in Python, by the way, because that's probably easier than doing it in C++. And as I mentioned earlier, the coordinator is going to verify that the workers get a commit or abort message rather than having the workers ask again. Why is that going to happen? Well, it's going to be done for you by the RPC system because you'll get a return value from commit or abort. That means the worker got the message. A note about this implementation. Since we don't have something like courses getting full, your workers may never agree to abort, and that's fine. So the only reasons we're going to have aborts are going to be things like crashes. And that's okay. And when I showed these examples, I talked about these options where, like, we resend things and so on, you know, in the cases where, like, we don't get a reply. To simplify the assignment, what I would like you to do is when you have a failure, just return an error from our call to you, saying, like, do this transaction, and just, we're going to restart your code. So you're just going to start over as if we rebooted everything. So your goal is just to make sure that if a failure happens, we're just going to reboot, you know, whatever failed, you know, reboot everything. And after, you know, everything gets booted up, we should be in a consistent state. And that's the big thing you're going to achieve. Okay. And I think I'm out of time. So we'll go over next time, you know, some examples of the kind of failure scenarios that can happen in two-phase commit, though I think you know enough to start the assignment. And then we'll move on to probably talking a little about access control. Before I sign off, any questions? So a question, is a failure indicated by an inconsistent state, we return an error? So a failure is going to be like machine can't be contacted. The question, are we going to be logging the actual transaction or commit abort? So to handle us restarting your machine, starting your coordinator in the middle of a transaction, it's going to need, you know, it or someone is going to need to know what actually needed to happen in the transaction. So we probably somewhere are going to need to put in the log what the value is for the transaction, in addition to whether it's committed or aborted. Any other questions?